Spoiler alert, every working relationship goes off the rails at some stage.
I'm here today with Michael Bungay Stainier. Michael Bungay Stainier, or MBS, is a renowned author, keynote speaker, and mentor, often recognized for the Coaching Habit book. He's the transformative force behind MBS.work.
You have a choices around who you, where you start and who you have these conversations with. You also have choices about how much depth or how much vulnerability you have in these conversations as well. There are options for you to go deeper. There's options for you to talk about stuff that's real and true and vulnerable and messy about you. You're in service to another person.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Learn, Speak, Teach on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm here today with Michael Bungay Stainier. Michael, MBS, what's happening? How are you?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on the show. You've had some really interesting guests before me, including one of my best friends, Mark Bowden. So I'm happy always to follow in Mark's footsteps.
Oh, my gosh. And I'll give a little context. So way back in the day, a friend of mine, Mike Polansky, he's a leadership researcher and coach. He had mentioned you as gave me a couple book recommendations. I added you on LinkedIn. And completely had forgot about it. And then...
Right, that's it. I'm done. I'm leaving. You've offended me. This is over.
And then I'm listening to Mark, who you just mentioned, Mark Bowden, yeah. Who's been on the show on Lewis Howe's podcast, I'm listening to you right. on the School of Greatness, yeah. mentioning Mark, and I thought you were brilliant. And I looked you up, and then I realized that you were recommended to me 2 years ago, and I had to question myself a little bit, but I'm happy we were able to circle back and make this work. The point of telling that short story is when someone's reoccurring, like recommended, you hear them on podcasts, you have a level of insight and omnipresence, which I think is just a reflection of the great work you get to do.
Also, just my persistence on begging people to be on their podcast. So there's that as well.
Real quick, how do you know Mark? Tell us about that relationship.
So he's British and moved to Toronto, 20 years ago or so, a little less than that. I'm Australian and via assorted routes moved to Toronto 21 years ago. And early days, like this is probably 15, 16, 17 years ago, we were just in some Toronto networking thing. Wow. I hit it off and went and had breakfast and liked each other. And then I pulled him in to come and work with me with a client. And we built this great working relationship, traveled around the world together. We've actually eaten in brilliant restaurants in Paris and in Singapore and in Amsterdam because he's a bit of a foodie. I don't know if he got into that with you, but he loves food. He's a great cook. We just became good friends. And in fact, I'm literally going out to dinner with him and his wife, Tracy, tomorrow night. We're going out for cocktails and then we're going out for a meal together. So, he's just one of my really close friends here. You know, sometimes you get lucky and you click with somebody fast and you're like, oh, this isn't just an interesting acquaintance. This is somebody who could be. This is somebody who laughs at my jokes. And, you know, there's something about a shared sense of humor. And I think him being from England and me being from Australia, we have a kind of shared background in terms of humor and how we see the world. It just helps accelerate a relationship.
I love that. It's short tangent, but James Altucher talked about a plus minus equal. And right. A plus is someone who's mentoring you. A minus is someone you're mentoring. And equal is a peer. Yeah. And what a great example about that peer support as you both kind of skyrocket to the moon together.
Right. And that's interesting. I mean, it's interesting if you hear that James Altucher kind of algorithm. Because like, so what's your bias around that? Like my bias is to move into mentoring or coaching relationships with people because I'm pretty good at it and I'm now getting old. So you're like, okay, I'm just like... you know, getting creaky. So now I just started, you know, giving advice and I've got some scars and I've got some stories. What I long for are equal relationships where there's this kind of balance between the relationship. And they're the hardest ones for me to form and to find.
Michael, I didn't introduce you to the listener that doesn't know you yet, so I'll do that real quick.
Okay.
Michael Bungay Stainier, or MBS, is a renowned author, keynote speaker, and mentor, often recognized for the Coaching Habit book. Sold over 1 million copies. That's a lot of copies, my friend.
Self-published as well, which makes it even more amazing.
Self-published and sold over 1 million copies. Testament that it's really helping people. He is the he's the transformative force. That's a big word for me today. Behind MBS.works. And his expertise lies in transforming complex ideas into practical, accessible knowledge, enabling individuals to unlock their own greatness. We're here to talk about a few things, but I specifically wanted to talk about your latest book, How to Work with Almost Anyone, because I just read it quite recently. And let's start there. I mean, just in the title, How to Work with Almost Anyone.
It's a good title, isn't it? You know, it's like when you're writing a book, often what you do is you get an idea for a book and you got a working title and you write it and the working title is okay, but it's not great. And occasionally, this is the first time it's ever happened to me, a perfect title appears, just like a vision in front of you. And I'm like, oh my goodness, How to Work with Almost Anyone is the best book title I've ever come up with. So now my challenge was to write a book that matched the title, whereas normally it's the other way around, which is like find a title that really kind of sells the book.
Is it first? Yes, incredible title. And is it fair to assume that we're going to have to work with people to be successful in our careers?
Well, I'd put it like this. I think our, not just our success, but our happiness is so dependent on our working relationships. You know, work happens through people. If you work in an organization, you probably heard people join organizations, but they leave managers because a bad working relationship, a bad controlling working relationship in particular, can kind of crush you. And even knowing that, which most people will nod their heads to going, you're right. You know, if I think of the worst working relationships I've had and the impact that had on me, it was significant. It sucked. And if I think of the best working relationships and the impact that had on me was elevating. I felt expansive. But most of the time, we just cross our fingers and we hope for the best. We hope doing the work, grinding, doing the best you can in the work is going to be enough. And it's not. You need to actually think about how do you actively manage the relationship, A, because that's going to have you two work better together and have more impact on the work, but it's also going to help you navigate the hard times, figure out how to repair things when things get difficult, and also find a way to elevate the very best of who you are and the best of your strengths so the two of you shine as best you can when you're working together.
I love this. There's navigating, there's repairing, which is something that unfortunately you have to fall into.
Oh, yeah. I mean, spoiler alert, every working relationship goes off the rails at some stage. I mean, sometimes it's drama and it's like, you know, hands waving and shouting and all of that, but mostly not. Mostly it's kind of quiet and passive and accidental and, you know, somebody hasn't had breakfast in the morning. Somebody misunderstood a statement. Somebody overpromised and underdelivered. You know, there's constant rips to the quality of our working relationships. The ability to recognize those small tears and actively do something about them significantly gives you a better chance of a better working relationship.
And that's what we want. It's all the perks of being on a team. There's gonna be issues that you might have to solve
times. That's right.
There, we won't go over every aspect of the book because I recommend people read it. I read it, but I also had the audio book, so it's like I love to have it read to me simultaneously. And then you brought on friends to actually share some of their relationships. We'll maybe get into that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But let's start with just kind of some of the keystone kind of keywords. There's the keystone conversation. There's right. best possible relationship. Let's start with those two terms in whatever order is best, the keystone conversation and best possible relationship.
Yeah, so the starting point is the big idea, which is what you're striving for is to build the best possible relationship, a BPR, with all of your key working relationships, every relationship that has some impact on your happiness and your success. So that might be your boss, it might be people you're leading, it might be collaborators, it might be vendors, it might be clients. if you look at your ecosystem around you, there are some working relationships that really make a difference between your success and to your happiness. And a BPR doesn't mean a perfect relationship. It's not all about, you know, unicorns dancing around and burping rainbows. It's you know, every working relationship has potential. How do you get it to be as good as it can be? So that means making the bad ones bearable. It means making the great ones shine brighter and for longer. It means making the average ones better than they were. So BPR, and there are three key attributes to a BPR. They need to be safe, psychological safety. People have been talking about that for a decade or more now. They need to be vital, because I think safety is not enough. It also needs to have some liveness to it. And then repairability, which we've already talked about, which is it needs to be fixable. So safe, vital, and repairable. And then the key tactic in the book is to say you need to have a keystone conversation. You need to have a conversation about how you work together before you get into the work itself. Or if you're already in the work, you need to stop the work briefly and go, hey, how should we work together before we get back into the work? Because this is not done very often and it feels a little awkward to get going on it. But that conversation about how you work together is what sets you up for the most success in the work that you do together.
So very open-ended question, but a case study example, like what does that look like? What's a common workplace dynamic? And, you know, what do we want to achieve with our best possible relationship? And what does that keystone conversation look like?
Well, look, here's something that you and I actually didn't do. We kind of did it through email back and forth, but we could have had this conversation before we kicked off and you hit the record button. I could have said, hey, Ben, I'm super excited to work with you. You've sent me questions as a kind of what we might get into in the content. So that's the work. But I could have said, hey, Ben, what makes a really great guest for you? Like when you think of the guests who have really shone, have been brilliant, been wonderful for you, that have brought out your best as an interviewer, that have been of most service to your audience. Tell me about that. What's the best? And then I go, and Ben, let me tell you the people who I love having conversations with. What makes a great interviewer for me? You know, let me tell you that. It's like they get my name right. They don't have a list of questions that they ask just one after the other, regardless of what my answers are. They get into the nitty gritty. Sometimes they go into weird corners. And we could have had that conversation to set us up before we got into the content. Now, we kind of did some of that. We talked about shared interests and people we know. And, you know, in your form to me, you're like, here are my favorite interviews and why they were great. So we did a little bit of that. But, you know, I should have been practicing what I preached and gone, let's talk about us before we get into the content of it.
Hey, and part of the beauty of diving right in is we get to have this conversation live. You luckily stumbled on the right podcast where I don't have scripted questions and we get into dark corners that sometimes right. I didn't know existed. So we'll see where we go.
Okay. That sounds good.
What about some of those challenging discussion. So us, you know, coming on and building rapport and kind of creating a vision together is fun and easy. I think people are really interested into the challenging stuff. Like, oh my gosh, I'm sweating. I don't know if I want to have this conversation.
Yeah. So I think it's one of the deep truths in me suggesting this process to people is that there's a degree of resistance around it, which is like, this feels difficult. This feels awkward. It feels unusual. I think those are all true. It does get better. It gets easier as soon as you do it. First time, a bit awkward. Second time, less awkward for sure. But you can start thinking about, okay, so who are the people I want to build relationships with? Sometimes the easiest place to start are the people who are already on your team. If you lead a team, and because you're the leader, you have a degree of authority, a degree of status, a degree of power, you're basically able to go, hey, Ben, you know, you work for me, you work with me, but I'm your boss technically.
Yes.
Let's you and me have a conversation about how we work together. And, you know, in the book, which is very practical, there are 5 questions to ask and answer. You might do some preparation. You might send the 5 questions to that person to do their preparation. And in the book, there's all these scripts about how you move your way through the conversation, from how you send out the invite to how you open it up to, you know, how you move through the middle and to how you finish strongly. you might also go, well, what if I did that with my boss? Everybody goes, ugh, who wants to do it with their boss? You know, that feels riskier. And it is a little riskier because, you know, there's a power differential. The boss has more power than you do, most likely. But I know, you know, I am a boss. I have two little companies. I work with people all the time. If somebody came to me and said, hey, Michael, can we have a conversation about how we best work together so I can be at my best and you can be at your best and we thrive together? I would be stoked. Mm. I'd be thrilled by that. That would actually indicate something about a level of emotional intelligence and a level of commitment and a level of leadership that I really look for in people. So you have a choices around where you start and who you have these conversations with. And you also have choices about how much depth or how much vulnerability you have in these conversations as well. Like you don't have to, you know, reveal everything, particularly to the people who you're like, I'm a little unsure about how this is going. There are options for you to go deeper. There's options for you to talk about stuff that's real and true and vulnerable and messy about you. But even if it's just like, let me tell you about me at my best. That's the first question, the amplify question. What's your best? When do you shine? When do you flow? You know, that's actually slightly awkward for some people because they're like, I don't know quite how to talk about that. It feels like I'm boasting. And I'm like, you're not boasting. You're in service to another person to let them know you at your best so they can contribute to it and bring it out to you. But there feels like there's less vulnerability around that than saying, the fourth question, the bad date question, you know, what can you learn from past frustrating relationships? That feels a little more vulnerable, perhaps.
I love this. And I love that the book literally is a guidebook. I'm all about the personal growth. I'm all about stories. But what's fantastic about your writing style is how deep you go into the actionable, like these are specific questions you can use. These are for specific circumstances you'll be in.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure it tremendously helps people to have, I'm sure people sit down and actually follow it as a script.
I had a flash of the bleedingly obvious this morning as I was walking back from the gym. I was like, you know, at my heart, I am a facilitator. Like I'm a good facilitator. I like working with the groups in a room or remotely. And I realized that my books are just a codified form of facilitation, which is like I'm trying to give you a process that moves you from A to B, because success for me is you changing your behavior. You're making a braver choice and doing something that you might not have done otherwise. And there's a lot of stuff out there around the ideas. Mm-hmm. If I can show you how to do it, if I can unweird psychological safety for you, which is one way of framing what this book is about, then I'd be thrilled by that.
Talk a little bit more about behavior change, because especially when I was younger and first started to read and first started to learn, it was almost infotainment for me. Like I would take the info in, I would be entertained, but my life wouldn't really change. And I felt stagnant for many years of my life. You talked about how true success in your eyes is actually a behavior change. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, let's start off by saying it's quite hard. It's like, you know, that's why there's a whole industry around, you know, habits and behavior change and the like, because it's hard. You know, the brain loves patterns. The brain loves the status quo. So your whole neural network is set up to basically not change that much. It's like, I'm trying to optimize for efficiency, and patterns and habits are efficient. So keep doing what you're doing. We all love that. What's the brain loves? Like, I love certainty. So keep change nothing. So in some ways, being active around behavior change goes against the very wiring of your own brain. So you have to figure out the wiring of your brain so you can work with it and kind of outsmart it at the same time. So I think there are two levels of habit of stuff around behavior change. The first is what lots of us now know about building habits. So Charles Duhigg started this off with The Power of Habit. I wrote a book called The Coaching Habit. Leo Babauta has Zen Habits. And then James Clear came in and went, I am doing Atomic Habits, and kind of like sucked the oxygen out of the room for everybody else writing about habits. But, you know, we know a bunch about habits now. And if you're one of the four people on the planet who hasn't bought James's Clear's book. Well, good for you for holding out. But, you know, it's like there's a trigger, there's a behavior, there's a reward. That's the basic pattern. So understand the trigger, understand what behavior you want to be different, and understand how to set up rewards so that your body goes, I'll keep doing that again. Your brain goes, keep doing that again. So habit building is really helpful. But I don't think it's sufficient. There's a book less well known because it's a little overly academic and a little long, but it's called I've forgotten its name. Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy, Immunity to Change. And they're building on other people's works, but they talk about in my book, How to Begin, actually, and also The Advice Trap, I talk about easy change and hard change. An easy change for me is kind of habit building, actually. You kind of explicitly know what you're doing. Hard change are all those things that you've been trying to change for years. You know, New Year's resolutions where you're like, this year for sure, I am writing a book, launching a podcast, telling my kids I love them more often, losing some weight, all the stuff that you're like, you kind of know how to do it. You just don't do it.
Right.
Knowledge is not the problem. You know, when you go, okay, I need to lose weight, what I'll do is I'll buy another book on weight loss. You're like, you don't need another book on weight loss. You already have content. And this is a deeper, deeper insight around behavior change, which is we are deeply committed to the status quo, which means we have commitments, often unspoken and almost unrecognized, to the status quo, often about keeping other people happy and maintaining our own status and our own ego. And you only get to break through some of that stuff when you figure out, A, what those deeper commitments are, and you figure out more profoundly what you need to say no to so you can say yes to a future version of you. It comes down to kind of two versions of you, present you and future you. And future you is calling you on. It's like a better version of you is waiting. And present you is like, don't change anything. You're fine. It's all good. And there's this constant competition. So when you set a New Year's resolution, that's future you calling you. And when you break the New Year's resolution, that's present you holding onto your ankles and going, don't leave me.
I'm curious. I love the concept of future you. And it's like, am I even going to recognize that person? Would that person be ashamed of my decisions? All these things.
Right.
I'm curious, what personal question, what are you personally doing in the past month, year, you know, preparing for your future self? Well, what are some of the things, the habits that you've enacted that have been helping you?
Yeah. Well, over the last couple of years, over the last 2 years, the biggest shift for future you has been to claim the identity of a writer. Now, I already had the identity of an author because an author is somebody who produces books, and I've written 8 or 9 books, so I can definitely tick the author box. But a writer is not about production, it's about identity. You know, what does a writer do? Well, a writer reads and they write. And most of my books I've written around the edges of running businesses, giving speeches, launching online stuff. You know, it's a secondary activity around the other stuff that I do. You know, vaguely entrepreneurial stuff. So a big thing, an evolution for me has been going, what does it mean to be a writer? What do I need to say no to so that I can say yes to being a writer? And I need to say no to giving as many speeches as I've done in the past. I say no to being as involved in running the businesses as I have been in the past. That's been a key evolution for me. And then recently my team and I have set a goal to sell 10 million copies of my books. Now, we've already sold 1.5 million copies, which is about 1.499 million copies more than I ever thought I would sell. So
not bad at all.
I've already won. But it's interesting. You know, I read a book recently called 10X is Easier Than 2X. which honestly is not a great book. It's just somebody shouting at you for 140 pages, 10x is easier than 2x. I'm like, I get it.
Is that Grant Cardone or is it anything
it's to do with that? It's not Grant Cardone. I mean, the 10x idea has been around and being used by a bunch of other people. But I was like, what's my 10x goal in terms of the impact that I want to make in the world? And, you know, I talk about my personal mission to being to infect a billion people with the possibility virus. How do I help a billion people make braver, see choices and make the braver choice? And part of that's around how do I get my ideas out and disconnected from me and spreading through the world? And, you know, when I thought about all my options, selling 10 million copies of a book feels powerful because you know, it's helpful for revenue, but it also is a way of idea spreading. It's kind of my best format is my books. Now, how do you sell 10 million copies of a book? I actually have no idea, and I throw up a little bit in my mouth when I think about it because I'm like, you know, there's a lot of books. There's a lot of books. But that feels like it's not a tactical thing.
Yeah.
It feels like it's an identity thing. So again, it's that kind of, it's a future you position to be, I'm a person who can sell 10 million books because present me is freaking out about that as a goal.
Well, and I'm sure you get to 9 million, you're still going to be tremendously proud.
Well, exactly. You know, as with all of these things,
the
goal, you can't get overly seduced by the actual goal you set. The goal you set is just directional. It doesn't even matter in the end. It's what process does this commit me to? What identity does this commit me to? And then you commit to that identity as best you can, and you commit to the process as best you can, and the outcome is the outcome.
Mm. Let's kind of go a layer deeper on like the purpose of the identity. So let's say you're at 9.9 million, you hit the 10 million mark. It's not like the world changes because you got to 10 million, but your life has changed on the path to get there. Like what does that future version look like? Who's being impacted? What do their lives look like? Why are you doing all of this? Because huge goal, what's the point?
Well, the point is how do I infect a billion people with the possibility virus? It's just connected to my mission. So it's like, it's my best guess at the biggest goal I've got to kind of connect to my mission. Mm. And, you know, a friend of mine goes, Michael, you're slightly messianic around your goals. I'm like, I am. I'm trying to make the world a better place.
Yes.
But I'm trying to do it in a way that doesn't have me positioned as a guru. I'm not really excited about this idea of I want to be the guru. I want to be the person. That's why this idea of a possibility virus is so interesting for me, because it's like, that's not about me. It's about ideas.
Go a little bit deeper on the possibility virus.
Well, it's got some elements to it. The possibility virus, at an existential level, it's like we are, as humans, we are at choice, but often we don't feel we're at choice. But, you know, it's the message from Man's Search for Meaning and every other self-help book, which is you're at choice. You can't control your circumstances, but you have a choice as to how you react to your circumstances. You know, between stimulus and response is freedom, Viktor Frankl. So how do you help people notice what their choices are in a moment? And how do you help people make the braver choice? That, if I can give people the skill to do that, that feels like it makes for a better world. What I like about it, but also what's ephemeral about it is, I don't get to see that. I don't get to measure that. I don't get to even know if it's working or not.
Right.
I'll never know. I mean, I assume I'll never hit a billion people, but I'll never know if I do, because my job is to try and find ways of getting stuff out in the world and spreading and passed from person to person. You know, part of why I'm so thrilled about the success of The Coaching Habit is people buy that book for other people. Right. People use that book to coach other people. So it's not just affecting the person who has the book. It's affecting the 20 people that they manage over the next 10 years in their career. And those people become better versions of themselves because coaching unlocks greatness. And then they make braver choices. And I'm like, those people will never hear my name. And that's great. I don't care. But if they're better versions of themselves, I feel I've made a contribution to the world.
It almost becomes like a billion live or dead. You know, this will continue to ripple beyond your own life, possibly.
It might. You know, I can't control that. You know, there's the famous poem by Shelley around Ozymandias, the ruler, you know, based on the Egyptian pharaoh. It's like, look around, ye mighty, and despair. I am Ozymandias, king of kings. The desert sand stretched to the horizons around the fallen statue. You know, it's like, after you're dead, you're like, I assume nobody will remember me in 100 years' time. All I can do is commit to the process at the moment, do the best I can to get good stuff out in the world at the moment. And then, yeah, I'm remembered, I'm not remembered. That's fine by me. I'll be dead.
Many years down the road, even if someone's not like, child, I read this book by MBS, but they were able to embody the concept based on their father, their friend, or their peer teaching them. And then that trickle down, yeah, you're never going to see what you sued, but it helps people. Yeah. And that's not just for, we're talking about you because I'm interviewing you. This is the listener as well, creating ripples in the lives and the relationships they build as well, correct?
Right. You know, I'm like, I am not a parent. I'm happily child-free. But you know, you read everything about parenting, and it's like, you know what? They watch what you do. They don't listen to what you say. So how do you embody something that your child looks at and goes, this is a quality I want to have in the world? And then they will do that with their partner and with their kids if they have kids, and with the people they work with. And it's all about just how do you pass on the best of us? And how do you minimize the worst of us? Because, you know, we're pulled back into the worst of us so quickly and so easily. I mean, you know, just look at the Israeli-Palestine conflict happening at the moment. It feels an embodiment of how something fragile breaks so quickly. And we're back to the most base instincts around that. So knowing that there's a constant pull towards chaos, entropy, how do you keep tipping slightly towards the best of us?
In one way I've discovered you do it, we already touched on it, is the peer-to-peer support, the peer mentorship, the building of relationships. One thing that I found fascinating when I had the audio version of your book is, again, I pay the extra little bits of money, but I stopped buying traditional books, even though I love them, but pulled my back out one too many times moving with, you know, hundreds of pounds of books.
I have the books around my table here that I need to get around to reading, so I hear you on that.
And not a problem. I get the Kindle and I get the audio book, and I actually put on noise-canceling headset, and I'm very scatterbrained, but this is a way I can kind of find my zen when reading. Yeah, and nice. I have the author read to me while I read along. But one thing that was fascinating about your book was you actually brought friends and peers on to discuss their best possible relationships as well. Talk a little bit about why you did that. I thought it was fascinating. Yes. It was like an add into the book, which was cool.
Well, it's a couple of things. It comes from, one part of it stems just from an irritation with the publishing industry. It's why I self-publish, or nowadays I hybrid publish. I work with a publisher called Page Two, and they're like, they bring all the expertise of publishing so that, you know, I produce a beautiful book that I love, and they help with distribution and an audio book and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm effectively the executive editor. I make the final decisions on all of this stuff. I get to create an artifact that I go, I love this artifact. Yeah. Like I get the final sign off on the cover. I get the final sign off on the internal design. All of that's my choices. And I think publishing is as an industry is just so deeply lacking in imagination. They're like, oh no, an audiobook just has to be somebody reading the book.
Right.
Like, you know, have you heard a podcast? They're reinventing the audio experience. Why aren't we doing something around that?
Sure.
So there's partly that, but partly also this comes down to the possibility virus again. You know, people talk a lot about privilege these days, and I'm glad we do. And I've got dealt most of the privilege cards. Like, I am a tall, white, straight, cis, hetero, overeducated,
good looking,
scholar, not that good looking, but that's fine. You know, Rhodes Scholar, best-selling author.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, if I'm not in a position of power, I've screwed up somehow, because I've got all of the cards to kind of do that. So one of the deeper quests for me is going, how do I be a great teacher and also get out of the spotlight, or find a way of sharing the spotlight, you know, decenter myself from the conversation. So you hear that in the possibility virus idea. And one of the ways that that shows up in a practical way is me going, how do I find other voices to share? So, you know, you heard from my friends and colleagues, and they're curated. Like, I want to make sure that there's an appropriate representation of women, an appropriate representation of people of color. I want there to be a diversity of perspective around that, because perspectives from people who look and sound like me are pretty common. And perspectives from other people are underrepresented. And I think part of this possibility virus is, and unlocking the greatness of the people around us, kind of coming back to how to work with almost anyone, is actually also getting to hear other people's voices.
I love that. And a little clarity for anyone who hasn't listened to the audiobook yet, it's after pretty much every chapter, you have a friend or colleague tell a story about their best possible relationship, correct?
Or sometimes their worst one.
Like, or their worst one. Spicy ones.
Yeah, me too. I was hoping for more of the like, this is the nightmare I went through.
Yeah.
But it's like, I asked people to, like, no more than 3 minutes, like 1 to 3 minutes. Yeah. Give me a story of your best working relationship and what that taught you, or what impact that had on you. Yeah, and it's like a really, I'm glad you mentioned it, because not many people do, but it's, I'm glad it struck a chord for you. So thanks, Ben.
I have a podcast. I'm a podcast junkie. When I put on an audiobook and there's these little bonus things, it's like behind the scenes music, right? Kind of feel. Yeah, yeah. I love this.
You know, in a previous audiobook where I've also got other people speaking and reading bits, one of my favorite things about it is in between each chapter, I play a chord on my ukulele. Now, I'm a terrible ukulele player. Like, I'm like a bad, bad amateur. Yeah. But the idea that I've professionally got a professional recording of me playing ukulele.
That's right.
And it just brings me deep joy.
My buddy Nick Gray hosts parties. And
The 2-hour cocktail party. Yeah, I do that too. Like, I've hosted 3 or 4 cocktail parties using his formula. It is a great book.
I haven't quite done it yet. It is a fantastic book.
You've got to step up.
Yeah, I read it during COVID, but that's no excuse. But the reason I mentioned Nick is he uses the harmonica in his audiobook. He uses it at the party to grab people's attention.
Right.
But he's got harmonica sounds in his audiobook, you know, questioning the typical standard of what an audiobook needs to be, and adding a little creativity to it. So I love it.
Oh, I just want if so I'm going to give a plug to Nick's book. You know, the insight he's got is, I think the deepest insight is we're all a bit lonely. And we all love to be invited out to stuff. And most of us aren't that great at inviting other people out to stuff. And he's like, you can get to build a community and get to know people by being the host. But of course, it's a bit intimidating being a host. So he gives you a step-by-step, play-by-play, email scripts, everything on how to host a 2-hour cocktail party. And the 2-hour really matters, because he's like, you start it, it's Tuesday or Wednesday, because those are the days most people have free. You start at 7, you are done by 9.
Yeah.
And people love that, because everybody's fear is like, it's a weeknight and somehow I'm at a cocktail party at 1 a.m. and I'm desperate to go home. But you're like, I will kick you out at 9 p.m. People are like, thank you. That was great. 2 hours. We got together. We interacted. it gives you facilitation tips, and then you kick them out, and you know, you really start to, for me, it's like I get a chance to reconnect with people who I don't really know. I don't have any real reason to get to know them, but I'm curious about who they are. So I get to invite them in.
Yeah. It's any from your neighbor to a colleague, to a friend, to a musician friend, you bring them all in a room, you bring icebreakers to the table. Exactly. There's a formula. It allows for vulnerability and connection. And before you know it, the musicians becoming best friends with your neighbor that you never thought would be hitting it off. So
exactly.
It's a Nick's been on the show. Nick Gray will be in the show notes. My team's amazing. We'll make sure that link's in the show notes as well.
And my challenge for you is like, stop talking about it. When are you going to host? When are you going to host a 2-hour cocktail party?
You're correct. That's I'm actually going to make a note to self.
Yeah, like it's already like mid-October when we're recording this.
Right.
So I'm going to say this.
And this will come out early next year. So
perfect.
That's so, a kind of a good stretch goal there.
Well, my challenge for you, if you want to pick it up, is I want you to have hosted a 2-hour cocktail party by the end of February 2024.
Okay.
And if not, you'll make a $1,000 donation to Nick Gray's charity of choice. I'm just making this up. You can say
you're adding stakes.
I'm going to say no to all of that, but I'm laying down a gauntlet for you.
And if you're listening to this for the listener, you can unsubscribe if I haven't done this by the February.
There we go. There we go. End of February.
I'm going to completely dox myself. I'm not worth listening to. I don't know what I'm talking about. I can't be held accountable.
And here's my request for you by the end of today, Ben.
Yeah.
Send Nick your commitment around hosting a 2-hour, an email, a 2-hour commitment. Just tell him whatever you want to agree to. You don't have to agree to the $1,000 thing, only if you want to. But you're like, make a commitment to Nick.
My physiology has actually changed slightly. I'm feeling a little on edge just thinking about it.
You see this little beads of sweat appearing on your forehead. Yeah.
In terms of like, and we'll do that 100%. In all terms of, I'm curious because you brought in all these brilliant minds in the audiobook to share their working relationships, good and the bad.
Yeah.
How did you reach out to them? So I collaborate with podcasting, all sorts of different things. The listener has their own creative endeavors, so we can kind of take the template based on what we're looking to do. But how did you bring in so many troops to make that happen?
I just relentlessly asked people. You know, there's probably about 20 people contributed to the audiobook. I probably asked 35 people. 10 said no. 5 never got back to me. 10 were a slam dunk because they're mates of mine. And I'm like, hey, Dan, you're my best buddy. You'll do this, right? And then it's like the Nick Gray approach to inviting people. You make sure you've got 5 or 10 people guaranteed before you then open it up to more broader invitations of people you don't know. So it's exactly the same formula as in Nick's book. It's like, so I made up a list of people who I'd love to have. I made sure it had my commitment to diversity. I started with the easy people. I'm like, these people would say yes. I then started asking around and asking people who I knew less well. And yeah, it's like I would ask people 4 times, send an email, resend, final send, because honestly, persistence is part of the game. You're like, after 4 emails, it feels like you're stalking. But
yes.
I reckon, often in 3 emails, they're like, okay, thanks for being persistent. I got distracted. Sure, this sounds fine. I make it as easy as possible. It will take you less than 10 minutes to do this. Here's the thing. Here's the script. Here are the prompts to answer the questions around that. Here's how you record an audio file. Here's how you send me an audio file. So I tried to remove any reason people might say, oh, I can't do this.
I love that. persistence is the key. There's not some magic wand, word salad way to do it. It's just reaching out. And you had already built, you know, a relationship and trust with these individuals, which I'm sure helped as well.
Yeah. Some of them I had, some of them I'd never met before.
Oh,
wow. My first time I've ever reached out to them. But, you know, the very first book I wrote, 2008, was called Get Unstuck and Get Going.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was even less well-known than I am now. I'm like, okay, so what does a book have? Well, books have people, famous people blurbing it. So I went to my bookshelf. At the time, everything was alphabetically arranged. So I pulled off the first A book. And it was by a guy called David Allen. Now, David Allen wrote a book called Getting Things Done. It was came out in like the year 2000. It was one of the first productivity books to really, really take off. It was huge. I'm like, I haven't even read this book, but I intend to. And this sounds interesting. So I go into, I don't think Google existed then. So I go onto a search thing and I find David Allen and Company, and there's a phone number there. So I'm like, okay. So I rang the phone number, probably on a landline, and on the first ring, the phone is picked up, and it's like, "Hello, David Allen here."
Wow!
And I'm like, "Oh man, I haven't prepared a pitch. That's I haven't quick. Done anything. I'm just like, I assumed I was just going to talk to leave a message or talk to an assistant or something." So I stumble out a request, and he says, "Okay, sure, send me a book." And then he wrote a nice blurb, and it kind of went from there. But it's like, you know, if Joe Rogan had a phone number on his website and you called it and he'd be like, "Hi, Joe Rogan here," you're like, "What's happened?" You know, it was a similar impact. Yeah. So that's where I kind of learned the lesson, which is like, just be brave, reach out. Doesn't always work.
That's fantastic. I called Ty Lopez once for work. He was on our lead list. I won't give away the specific details, but his business came up. I called and I didn't get Ty Lopez. The probability of getting to the person just for the phone call, that's ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah.
What else? We're going to transition into the rapid fire round. These are short, sweet, random questions.
Yep.
But did we miss anything? I mean, we missed a lot of things.
Well, rather than answering that, because that's an infinite question.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Of everything we've talked about so far, what's been most interesting or useful for you?
That's a good question. Well, for me personally, it's the accountability piece of the Nick Gray host my cocktail party. In addition to that, just the understanding and the empathy that things aren't always going to go our way, and the need to have that intention of setting a best possible relationship. Right. And you can set big goals, but it's those relationships along the way that allows you to get to 10 million books sold, things like that. That's probably my biggest takeaway.
Fantastic. All right, this is rapid fire.
Let's actually do this one more thing, because this isn't a takeaway, but this is in kind of a assignment for the audience. I do this in my shorter segment podcast, but we'll do it right now. An integration assignment. We talked about actually, you know, implementing and taking the action to change our lives. I mean, this is just info unless we take even a baby step in the right direction because of the info. So, well, what is that baby step? What integration assignment would you give the audience?
Well, it depends a little bit on what's been most useful for them to decide what the action is they'd like to take. But if we centered around the new book, How to Work with Almost Anyone, and you've got you've got the key idea and you've got the key tactic. The key idea, build the best possible relationship with your key people, the ones that help influence your success and your happiness. And the key tactic, have a conversation about how you work together before you plunge into the work itself. The integration, or the kind of the next step, the call to action, the CTA, is be the person who reaches out. You know, somebody said, it's like Nick Gray again. It's like, I love that we've introduced him to this. It's like, be the person who invites somebody to have that conversation. You know, nobody likes to be the first person to say hello, but everybody loves to be greeted. So if you're the person willing enough to, and this is an act of leadership and vulnerability in itself, to say, hey, let's have this conversation, that already changes things. So pick one person. It might be somebody you feel safest with. You're like, yeah, I'll try it out with them. or it might be a working relationship which has gone so badly wrong that, quite frankly, it can't get any worse. So you're like, I've got nothing less to lose. Why don't I give it a go? But pick a person, send them an email and say, hey, what if we had a chat about how we're working together or how we will work together, just to see if there's anything we can do even better to bring out the best in each other.
Love this.
And if you want to, like, if you don't want to pick up the book, that's fine. Right. Bestpossiblerelationship.com. You can A, get a download of the five questions. So you can actually kind of see what the five questions are. And B, there's a video of me actually having a keystone conversation with somebody. So you can actually see what that looks like and sounds like in real life. So if you're like, I'm not even sure what this is yet, you can just go to bestpossiblerelationship.com and you can actually see what that looks like.
Fantastic. So between hearing this conversation, which was very nuanced, receiving the actual guideline in a PDF or watching it,
yeah,
we can reach choices. All the learning styles
yeah.
here.
Yeah, you got some choices.
I love the choices. So these are random questions. I kind of make them up on the spot sometimes.
Yeah, great.
But you're an interesting individual, so I'm curious what most people don't know about you that you possibly might want to share. What's something unique about you that you love?
Well, some people will hear this in my voice, and if you are watching the video, you might see this, but one of the things that's true about me is that I have a cleft lip and palate, sometimes called a hair lip. What that means is when I'm born, my top lip isn't fully formed. There's a kind of gap at the top. That's why it's called a hair lip, because you kind of look like a rabbit, H-A-R-E. So, and also the top of my mouth isn't kind of smooth in one piece like everybody else's. It's got a gap in it as well. So as a young kid, I have operations and it sews up the top of my mouth and kind of creates plastic surgery on my lip. So I have a full top lip. And for me, it's, and often if you have a cleft lip and palate, you've got a facial difference and that can bring all that kind of anxiety and self-consciousness that every teenager has about everything, but you have as about your particular point of difference. But for me, it turns out to be, I think, one of the things that is interesting and different about me. And when I think about it in my role as a teacher or as a speaker, I like being slightly less polished, more vulnerable when I'm speaking, because most speakers are like, look at my polished presentation. And they're like, look at me up here and you down there. There's a greater gap between teacher and audience. Whereas I'm constantly going, how do I raise my audience? How do I lower my own status and raise my audience's status so that they're actually more engaged, they're better able to learn? And so I don't tend to use PowerPoint, for instance. I just use a flip chart where I'm writing stuff up, so it's a bit rough and ready. But I think, to answer your question, what is something that you don't know about me? Is I think my cleft lip and palate is one of the attributes about me that makes me feel A, different, and B, accessible to people.
What a fruitful answer to a silly question. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So you're a writer. So let's say you were to sit down with three other writers, live or dead, and have an opportunity to learn from them. They can be your plus in this relationship, and you can ask them anything you'd like.
That's so good.
What writers would you have at the table with you?
That's pretty hard. I have a master's degree in literature, so I read a lot. So I have some pretty epic writers that I'd love to meet. I mean, James Joyce would be pretty amazing. I mean, Ulysses is an incredible book, even if I don't understand most of it. Maybe a British writer called Angela Carter. She kind of wrote amazing books around feminism and magic realism. John Donne, the Renaissance English poet, my wife's favorite poet. And his story is incredible in terms of, he's written the best love poetry ever. Also the best religious poetry ever, because he loved his wife dearly. Then she died and then he became a preacher and moved to kind of God rather than kind of physical human love. he would be extraordinary to talk to. All of those people would be absolutely intimidating to talk to, but they'd be pretty cool to sit down with.
And we'll have to pull up another chair for your wife so she can be a part of this unbelievable conversation. I know. She's as like, well.
You had dinner with John Dunn and you didn't invite me? That is a divorceable act for sure.
Final quick question. What's one thing, and you can repeat something we talked about, what's one thing that leaders get wrong and how can we change it?
We're kind of connecting back to a broader theme of my work, which is leaders overrate how good their advice is. They're like, you know, your advice has its place. I'm not saying never give advice. But, you know, the key theme from the Coaching Habit and the Advice Trap books, which are the ones I'm best known for, is can you stay curious a little bit longer? Because your advice is often not nearly as good as you think it is. And it's not the thing that's actually being asked for. The thing that's being asked for is for you to hold space for people to figure some stuff out and to actually see people and to hear people and to recognize people and to give them the space to help them make some mistakes, find some answers, be the authors of their own story. So, again, you know, there's a role and a place for advice for sure, but it's just, you are far more valuable as a leader if you become the person who helps people figure out what the real challenge is rather than being the person who's just there with a quick answer.
MBS, I appreciate you taking the time with me. I am an advocate for all you do. If the listeners want to continue to support, again, what can we do to help you out?
Oh, thank you. Well, best possible relationship if you want the stuff, the free stuff from the new book, How to Work with Almost Anyone. If you've got one of my books, a review somewhere, always deeply appreciated. That's just one of those, you know, social proof things that people like, and I like as well. If you want more general stuff about me, mbs.works is my website, and that's where you find all the free resources with the other books. It's where you find me on social media and all that sort of stuff. So go and hang out at mbs.works and take whatever you fancy.
Love it. I know you're more of a writer than a speaker for the future, but I'll have you back to speak anytime you're available. You. I appreciate your time and a fantastic dialogue. Thanks again.
I really enjoyed it too. Thanks for your time as well, Ben.